Clive, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
So what did you expect and what did you find when you went to visit Gordon Bell?
Well, I think I expected that there would be this guy who has this this kind of amazing external brain that would just give him perfect recall of everything immediately. And I could ask him, you know, who's the person that sat next to you on the plane 3 weeks ago? And, you know, what was the recipe that you cooked, you know, 2 years ago for dinner? And that would be this very precise thing because all the information is there. And it's true. All the information is there. But he hasn't quite figured out how to organize it and sort it perfectly. So so although he would sometimes be amazing at recall, like, you know, he was talking about a jazz symphony that he saw in Australia, and so he just played me the file. It was just very, very funny moment. He's like, oh yeah, he's trying to describe it, and he realized he doesn't need to describe it, he can just play it for me. You know, same thing with some conversations. He would think, you know, he'd play me phone conversations rather than have to describe them. So sometimes it was amazing, but a lot of the times he would start to try and find something and then spend 20 minutes trying to find it.
Exactly.
and eventually sort of get lost in this buggy software, because it's a new piece of software. It's not, you know, it's they're working on it's a
so
demo.
It's,
you know.
So it's easy to preserve all this
yes.
raw data, but it's extremely hard to lay your hands on exactly the piece he wanted at that time. But isn't he developing, or aren't other people developing for him programs to do that? Life Browser, DevonThink, Remembrance Agent, Facet Map?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff out there. They call it the life logging community.
Mm-hmm.
You're logging your life. And everyone acknowledges that it's actually easy to save the stuff. Easier than ever to save stuff, because we have these hard drives that can just, very cheap, they'll store everything, but very hard to make sense of it. And that's really the holy grail quest right now. How do you make this information you've got useful in some sort of way? You know, do you have a situation where, like at Microsoft, they have this thing called Facet Map. It's this beautiful sort of graphical interface where you can zoom down on any one thing and it's connected to everything else. Like, you could say, okay, show me last Thursday, and it'll show you all the emails you sent and all the documents you looked at and all the websites you looked at. And then you might go, well, let's look at those websites. And you find a website, and it might show you all the other days that you access that website. So you can sort of tunnel through your memories in very interesting sort of dreamy ways.
And
you know?
Is it also Facet Map that uses not just, you know, days or time periods, but you can also drill down on a person?
Oh, yeah,
tell me everything about my Aunt Susie that
up. And that's very useful, because what will happen is you go, well, you know, I know that I talk. You'll think, okay, well, you know, Brooke mentioned this book to me. I can't remember the name of the book. So I'll start by just looking at everything I have that's related to Brooke. And I'll remember that you said that to me, I don't know, a month ago when I was on the show. So I'll look at all the communications I had with you a month ago. And so it actually becomes very quick to find the name of the book, because I find the email or the conversation. And so it works very well that way, because that's sort of the way our memories work. Psychologists have long discovered that we organize our memories very often based on people and time. One of those two things. People will remember when something happened, or they'll remember who told it to them. And if you put those two things together, you can index the vast majority of your memories very quickly.
And so the idea, so if you want to be able to find this information, you have to sort of replicate what your memory would naturally do.
Yes, exactly.
And you focus quite a bit on the effect that a surrogate brain has on actual carbon-based memory, our physical minds. And you say, the digital version really does influence the flesh one.
Sure, absolutely. Well, I mean, what Gordon has found is that it's changed the way that he decides to remember things and what he decides to remember. Because a lot of things he will simply just not bother remembering anymore, because he knows he's got a copy of it there and he can find it again. And he compares it to doing long division. I mean, he could probably remember how to do long division if he really thought about it, but he doesn't need to, because he has pocket calculators. And his argument is that this is a sort of like what memory devices will do for this. And you know, and this is not far off, because you think about, just think about our behavior with our mobile phones. A lot of people can't remember the phone numbers of their very, very close associates because their phones remember it for them, and they put it in once and they forget it. And if you ask the average person, what's, you know, Jim's phone number, they won't be able to tell you half the time.
And I was thinking that Gordon Bell's long division metaphor wasn't as good as your cell phone metaphor that you used in the piece, because in the case of cell phones, often we don't bother to commit those numbers to memory at all.
That's right.
To begin with, they go straight into the phone, and it, long division we were forced to learn at some point.
That's right.
We have the luxury of forgetting it, but not these phone numbers. Without our cell phones, we're lost.
Right. And actually, in Europe, where people will their phone is really has thousands of email of phone numbers and emails in, because it's their central device. For us, we use a lot of email and computers. In Europe, they use their phones a lot more. There is a huge anxiety about losing your phone or losing the memory on your phone. They have all these backup devices for like saving all your phone information, because you'll see these Europeans and they just like emotionally destroyed if they lose their phone, because everything was on it. You know, all their people, all their friends, and they have to go back and reaccumulate that all over again. It's like having a stroke. You know, like the information is all gone.
Exactly. And actually, you met another life blogger, not Gordon Bell, who actually went through a kind of digital stroke, a crash of his computer.
Yeah. He lost about 4 months.
Who is this?
This is Jim Gemmell, and he is one of the software engineers who works along with Gordon on essentially trying to figure out ways to sift through Gordon's enormous, you know, decades of memories. And so Jim decided, you know, as he developed the software, that he would do it himself. He would start doing his own My Life Bits, his own life logging, and he showed me it's wonderful. He's got some amazing things. He was showing me, you know, records he has of trips he's taken with his kids, and some really wonderful stuff that, I mean, is quite very emotionally touching. But what happened was that he had a crash and he lost about 4 months of it. And up until then, he had sort of thought, well, this is just this funny little experiment. I'm doing it to sort of learn how to make the software. I don't really rely on this stuff. But once the information was gone, he realized that he did rely on it, that it was like, you know, hot water or lights in his house. And then when he lost it, he felt absolutely bereft. And I've seen that feeling even myself. You know, years ago, before I started backing up a lot, I you know, sort of played it fast and loose, and I had a few computer crashes, and I lost half a year of my journalism work, and it felt incredibly strange and difficult. So I think this is an experience that many people can, as we rely more and more on machine memory, we're actually having those experiences every day. You know, we lose things, we break things, our Palm Pilot breaks, and suddenly we realize, oh, we don't have a copy of this stuff. A, I don't have a copy of it, and B, I rely on it.
Now, there's a difference between losing your journalism work, which is something that you may have stored on disks. It's your past material. It's your resume, as it were. Then losing that day at the beach you spent back in April. I mean, your brain was still working then, wasn't it? Don't you still have it?
Yeah, theoretically. I mean, the workings of human memory are very... very complex. And this is one of the interesting things, is that we're sort of forging ahead with a lot of artificial memory, even before we really understand how our real memory works. And so psychologists are as yet uncertain as to what the effect of all this virtual memory will be. Will it really be true that we'll sort of stop remembering things, or will it release us to remember things in different ways? Or in some cases, will it make our memories better? Because the one thing that some scientists found in Ireland, they took Gordon's little camera that he wears around his neck. It takes pictures every minute or so all day long. And, you know, so he's got thousands and thousands and thousands of these pictures. And you think, well, what are you ever going to do with those? You're never going to look at them again, right? Well, what these guys in Ireland discovered was that if at the end of the day you look at all those pictures, just, you know, blip, 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 really quickly scroll through them in about a minute, you relive your day as seen out your eyes, and it dramatically improves your long-term recall of what happened. So by doing this little one-minute exercise at the end of every day, you actually improve your real brain's memory of what happens to you every day.
And this has been applied to people who are afflicted with short-term memory impairment, right?
That's right. This has been done with a woman in England who has a very severe form of amnesia. She really has no recall past a day or two. And so what she started doing was that every time there was an event or something that she wanted to remember, a dinner with her husband, perhaps, or a party, she would make sure that she wore this camera. And then after the event was over, she would review the images every day for a couple of days. And she started being able to remember this stuff. Like it would last for months. And this is a woman who had ordinarily forgotten this within 24 hours.
And you can really see the value of it in that case.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
I guess I'm still a little, I guess I still find puzzling why we need this kind of recall in our everyday life. Unless you believe, as many people do, that really all we are our memories. Are we fuller, more complete people if we can hold on to that stuff? What's the broader picture? What is the broader value of all of this?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think that what's going to happen is that people will sort of make decisions about what type of memory they want to have. And that's a very interesting proposition because we haven't been able to do that up until now. We're sort of stuck with whatever you've got. But you might decide that, you know, I'm actually someone who just wants to see that one perfect picture from last summer. You know, the sort of classic shoebox idea, whereby by the time you're 60, you've got a shoebox full of pictures, and that's all you've got. And that's what you might have had 50 years ago. And there's something very poetic about that, because you have these little snapshots that represent an entire, you know, year in your life. And when you look at it, you recall everything. And that's a really majestic, almost poetic way of looking at your life. And you'll find other people who really want to have everything there. And you can already see that impulse a little bit with some bloggers or some of the people who use Flickr a lot, where they take pictures all day long and they post them to Flickr, which is a site for storing photos. Or they blog. They blog about their thoughts. I mean, I do that every day or every week. And I've discovered it's going to be quite interesting to go back 2 years. I mean, I've been doing it for 4 years now. Go back 3 years and look at what I was thinking about in my own words. And it's sort of just scroll through a month and revisit, what was going through my mind, what was going through my life. So you'll find people who sort of choose the way they want to remember things. And that's a very new thing. We might make bad decisions. I think some people might, you know, choose to record a lot of stuff and then realize later on that, my God, why did I do this? And I sort of can't get rid of it because maybe it's out there and it's on Google and it's being recorded by search engines, you know. In the same way that some kids are discovering now that all the stuff they put on their websites is being Googled by their employers, you know. And like, wait a minute, you know, I'm not going to hire this guy who, you know, who was, you know, I don't know, did this particularly stupid thing some summer 2 years ago. So, you know, we'll make decisions about what type of memories we want to have. And in some cases, the decisions will be taken out of our hands. And that's where things get, you know, troubling, potentially.
Gordon Bell has argued that if you're not spending all this brain power on remembering stuff that you can store and eventually put your fingers on pretty quickly, hopefully, you can free it all up for more creative thinking. Is there any indication that offloading your memories gives you more headspace for creativity?
Well, it might. No one has studied it experimentally. Like, there's no actual real data backing up what Gordon says. Although, you know, he certainly reports feeling that way. And, you know, he's the best experiment we've got in that regard. I know other people who report that. Cory Doctorow, a very prolific blogger and novelist, who was one of the founders of the very famous blog Boing Boing, says that the reason why he started Boing Boing was because he was just encountering all this stuff and he wanted to get it out of his head and on digital paper somewhere, so that it became, as he called it, his outboard brain. And it sort of freed him up just to sort of chew through more and more stuff, because it was always, he always knew that he could go back and look at the stuff there and he didn't have to worry about holding it up there. And so I think there's something to that idea. It hasn't been experimentally proven, but I think it's an interesting concept. I've noticed it a little bit myself. Like, for example, if I go to do an interview with someone, I could take notes by hand, which is sort of a memory device, but it takes a lot of work. I have to think carefully about what I'm writing down. Or I could put a tape recorder down, and it frees me to just think about what the person is saying because I'm not worrying about recording it.
Right.
So there's I've seen a little bit of that. But truthfully, you know, you could imagine the opposite. You know, if we know we've got something recording our memories, maybe we become sloppy, or maybe we don't sort of live in the moment in certain important ways.
There's so much flotsam and jetsam floating around. I always thought a big part of creativity was simply sorting and organizing that stuff. So I wondered whether whether or not by delegating that activity to a device, you've actually eliminated one of the most creative mechanisms of interpreting the world.
That's right, because I'll go back to my comparison of me in an interview. Sure, I put a tape recorder down, and that frees me to think about what the person's telling me because I don't have to take notes. But taking notes is sort of a mental activity. I have to while I'm there, pay attention to things, think of what's most important, what strikes me the most, and then I write that down. So I'm actually doing thinking even as I'm writing. And I discover sometimes that the notes I've taken do a better job of representing what was the most important things this person said to me than listening to a two-hour tape recording of it, where the sort of urgency and the experience of the moment is gone. So you could think about, well, will it be like that in real life? If I know that I've got this sort of recording of everything happening at my kid's birthday party, will I stop sort of noticing in the moment the most beautiful or important things? You know, I've had friends tell me, I've got friends that, you know, are really crazy about video camering everything. And you've probably seen people like this. They show up at a party. They don't look at anything. They just look at it through the lens the whole time. And on the one hand, you know, what they'll tell you is that there's something kind of neat and artistic about seeing things framed through a lens the whole time. And so they're kind of enjoying it. It's almost like a Hollywoodization of the thing. But on the other hand, you sort of wonder, well, are they not really seeing what's in front of them and experiencing it because they're so focused on trying to record it?
Yeah, I guess if we believe everything we've got is mediated in one way or another, maybe it's better to be our own mediator.
Sure.
Let me ask you a question that kept occurring to me when I was talking to Gordon Bell. Do you see this whole development of life blogging as evolutionary, just an extension of saving our email and having our numbers in our cell phones and the way we engage with technology to deal with information overload, that kind of thing? Is it an evolutionary move, or is it a revolution? Does it change our relationship with machines now, henceforward?
Well, I think it has, in the long term, it has a very revolutionary impact for sure. But it's already happening, and it's already been happening for several years now. So that's, in that sense, I think it is kind of like a slow evolution. You know, I think back again to when I first decided to start blogging 4 years ago, and now it's just sort of a daily part of my life. I've got friends, again, who sort of started buying cheaper and cheaper digital cameras, and then just for the heck of it, taking a lot of pictures, and then just for the heck of it, putting them online. And, You see computers arriving with bigger and bigger and bigger hard drives, so people stop having to throw stuff out. Like 10 years ago, I filled up my hard drive on my Macintosh. It had two megs, right? So I get to the point where, like, wow, I have to start throwing documents out. I have to start pruning my memory. Nobody does that anymore. They just save everything. And my prediction is that about 3 years from now, when you buy your Dell computer, it'll come with a voice over IP telephone apparatus just as part of it. Your phone will be your computer, and it'll be, you know, configured probably automatically just to log all your phone calls, you know, so that's the way it'll arrive. So that, you know, for 3 or 4 years from now, every phone call of yours will just be saved, you know, without even thinking about it. And in that sense, it's evolutionary. Every year we get one more little thing that comes along that starts remembering more of our lives without us sometimes even having decided to do it. And that could be a little creepy for the people who don't want to do that.
Yeah. I mean, privacy then becomes a huge issue, doesn't it?
Sure.
There are certain things we'd all rather not remember. If you know, you're engaged with, you know, one or two other people, one of them's bound to have it on tape.
That's right. It's very hard to escape the fact that someone out there could be, you know, blogging or recording us. The great joke about a year ago, 2 years ago, was this T-shirt that people would start wearing saying, I'm blogging this. So you show up at a party and it was a joke, you know, there's a blogger here somewhere and they're going to be writing about it. But you mentioned privacy, but I think there's also sort of a very weird form of privacy when you have this automatic recording capability, which is privacy from yourself, which is, you know, the fact that there's parts of your life that maybe you shouldn't remember, and that making sense of your life is as much about forgetting the vast majority of it or subtly distorting it as it is perfectly remembering it. And that's how, and you know, any psychologist would tell you that forgetting is an incredibly important part of how we make sense of ourselves and our lives. And being able to re-experience directly everything might be, you know, sort of nightmarish. One psychologist mentioned to me the Borges story, Fune is the Memorious. And it's a fictional story of a guy who has a head injury and suddenly he can remember everything with perfect recall. And he says, my mind is like a junk heap. Because, of course, it turns out that if he can remember everything, nothing has any particular value. Because the only reason certain memories have value is because they're the few that our brains have preserved from amongst the millions of possibilities. The rest of it's gone. And that's actually a meaningful and good thing. And the very few times that psychologists have encountered people with absolutely perfect recall, and it has been found, it's very rare, sort of mental condition where people literally can, if you ask them, 2 years ago on this day, what did you do? They'll be able to tell you. These people do not have remarkable lives in any way. You would think that they're smarter or that they did better at college, and they're not. They often have very, very nondescript lives, and they don't necessarily have a better emotional experience of their lives. In fact, they sometimes describe themselves as going into sort of a memory trance, because if someone merely mentions a particular day several weeks ago, they'll immediately be flooded with the memories from that day, and they can't turn them off, and they sort of sit there in a trance for half an hour, unable to stop them. So there are now, this, of course, is not necessarily the way that Gordon Bell's device works. He can turn it on or off. But there are some potential warning signs if you look at the psychology of forgetting that suggests that the idea of remembering everything may be, in some cases, very horrifying. And or maybe not horrifying is the wrong word for it, but it might not be as much of a gift.
Debilitating.
It might not be as much of a gift as we think it would be.
Clive, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Clive Thompson covers technology for a number of national magazines, and he's a contributing writer for Fast Company magazine, and he has his own blog called collisiondetection.net.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.